This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Hero's Journey, Joseph Campbell on His Life and Work, by Joseph Campbell. Edited by Phil Cousineau. Foreword by Stuart L. Brown. Performed by David DeVries, Patrick Lawler, and Emily Sutton Smith. Foreword. Passion makes most psychiatrists nervous. Joseph Campbell sounds like a displacement of your need for a messiah, a prominent analyst friend said to me early in my quest to assure that the best of Campbell would be memorialized on film and television. That dream materialized in the 1987 production of The Hero's Journey, the one-hour film from which the book you hold in your hands emerged. Zeal for something other than sports and church makes most Midwestern Presbyterians tense, and both of my aging parents clearly would have been more comfortable if this Campbell interest had been supplanted by my energetic support of a local congregation, or by more attention to my medical activities and financial future. Since it is poor judgment and bad manners not to listen to mentors and parents, I have, since the inception of my long and intricate involvement with Joseph Campbell, tried not to embrace him as a cult figure and have good and irreverent friends who assure me that I keep thinking and feeling for myself. But as I try to place those years in perspective, the experience of it all feels more like love. Not specifically love of Campbell, but love for what happens to others when they see and hear him. Their pleasure and their growth were what kept me working on this project for more than a decade. Of course, the awareness of what would happen to others as they encountered Campbell started with my own experiences. At age 39 in 1972, I took a sabbatical to complete a research project on homicide. While closeted in the library, I discovered that the earliest known written references to violence were mythological. And to my surprise, the dynamics of domestic violence described in the ancient myths and the patterns of domestic violence in contemporary American life showed striking parallels. So I set about to read Joseph Campbell's four-volume Masks of God. As I finished, I realized that Campbell was remarkably connecting the symbolic, psychological, spiritual, and artistic heritages of humanity in ways that an army of scientists since Darwin had been doing in order to understand biological patterns. Along the way, something in me more than intellect had been fed by these books. As I completed them, I felt differently about myself and the world. I felt at home. I wanted to learn more about what Campbell had to say, and, like many others, I was curious about the man himself. The more I read, the more I was moved by an incessant urge to see that Campbell's sweeping scholarship and capacity for tolerantly blending the world's mythologies were made available to audiences outside the scholarly community.
They thought that it would be a disgrace to go forth as a group. Each entered the forest at a point that he himself had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no path. Where there's a way or path, it is someone else's path. Each human being is a unique phenomenon.
Joseph Campbell, Goddesses, Mysteries of the Feminine Divine. Since I was not a television professional myself, I formed a partnership with the late Greg Sparlin. Campbell, however, initially rejected our proposal to transfer his work into the television medium with the remark that his proper medium was print. It took many meetings to persuade him otherwise, but when we finally got his commitment, I was certain that we could get others properly exposed to Campbell's scholarship and vitality, and they would experience their own deepening of soul. It didn't matter to me at the time that few agreed with this conviction. As with many creative projects, there were many false starts. By late 1981, I was becoming increasingly concerned about Joe's health, since he had experienced 2 severe bouts of pneumonia within 6 months. While he looked fine and sounded as eloquent as ever, the physician in me was worried. Joe was approaching 80, and there still was no adequate filmed record of him and his work. Yes, he had published many superb books, but I felt strongly, as George Lucas was later to say, that there was a life force that poured out of him, causing his audiences to actively initiate their own spiritual adventure. With an increased sense of urgency, I redoubled my efforts. The formal filming of the hero's journey began in January of 1982 at Esalen in Big Sur, California. With producer Bill Free's help, I corralled a diverse group that ranged from Joe's close poet friend Robert Bly to Nobel laureate Roger Guilleman to a young woman who had never heard of Campbell before. My hope was that the mix of people, the skills of the director David Kennard, the beauty and heritage of the setting, and the phenomenal life and energies of Joseph Campbell would provide a rich foundation for our film. Much of what you will discover in this book comes from the conversations filmed at Esalen. Some 4 or 5 months later, as we were editing the film and poring over transcripts, I began to find myself besieged by a relentless inner voice. Inner voices, even if they were telling me to follow my bliss, were not something I was used to. But this one kept saying, "Get Joe's next nationwide lecture series on videotape, because it will be his last." Sadly, it was. Some people are at their best in a relaxed, informal setting. The first cut of our film used a great deal of such footage. However, the more we worked on it, the clearer it became that Campbell was at his best when he chose the subject matter, when he was able to use the material that he had perfected over many decades of lectures. Between 1982 and early 1985, a production crew followed Campbell around the country, videotaping his last major lecture tour. We recorded Psyche and Symbol in Taos, New Mexico, Transformations of Myth Through Time in Santa Fe, The Perennial Philosophy, Hinduism and Buddhism at his wife Jean Erdman's Theater of the Open Eye in New York, The Western Way, The Arthurian Legends, and The Quest for the Grail at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater in San Francisco, and Contemporary Mythologies, James Joyce and Thomas Mann at the California Historical Society in San Francisco. We now had a motherlode of 50 hours of Campbell's most powerful lectures, which will be available forever. I have since stopped hearing voices. Editor's note: these filmed lectures are now available as the video series Mythos. As the production crew and I followed Campbell around this country, people kept coming up to me after his lectures and seminars asking, "Who is this man, Campbell? How did he get to be the person he is?" An enduring curiosity about who he was and an enchantment with him and his ideas pervaded his audiences. It was these questions that provided the stimulus that led to the final form of the first film and, ultimately, to this book. Our final strategy for the film was to allow the viewer to process unconsciously his or her own life while watching the story of Joe's, their own personal rites of passage, their recognition of the importance of union with nature, their need to take their own path. In short, the trajectory that Joe Campbell lived out and so magnetically demonstrated in the breadth of his scholarship would be discovered in the vignettes and stories, monologues, and interactions that we had filmed. For me, the highlight of the film is the awards dinner at the National Arts Club of New York in 1985, where Joseph Campbell was honored for his contributions to literature. Our film had time only for excerpts from the testimonials of George Lucas, Richard Adams, James Hillman, and others, and as much as it pained us, we were forced to cut Joe's soaring acceptance speech. Fortunately, this book has allowed us to incorporate more complete coverage of that remarkable evening, as well as to include marvelous original material that time constraints excluded from the film. Joe always felt his ideas were more significant than his person. In the film and in the construction of this book, we have tried to make sure that it would be as he wished it, that the ideas speak with all of the remarkable clarity that the man was capable of generating. The film version of The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell, premiered on the East Coast at the Museum of Modern Art and on the West Coast at the Directors Guild Theater in the spring of 1987. Included in this book are excerpts from his last public appearance at the West Coast premiere program where, even as he approached what he himself called the death, he continued to provide new information and syntheses to his audiences. It was with great poignancy that I watched Joe receive his last standing ovations. He died 4 months later. After much review of our transcripts and outtakes, I asked Phil Cousineau, the associate producer of the film, who along with co-producer Janelle Balnike wrote its narration, to construct this book. I had been consistently impressed with his important creative contribution to all aspects of the film and to his growing devotion to Joe and Gene Campbell, and I knew that they recognized and appreciated not only the breadth of his knowledge of myth and life, but the depth of his talent. In 1988, the national airing on PBS of The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell, and Bill Moyers' six-part series, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth, led to an explosive and broad response. This outpouring of interest, it seems to me, has confirmed that Joseph Campbell speaks to all of us. Stuart L. Brown. Preface to the Centennial Edition. Late one night in the spring of 1987, I sat with Joseph Campbell on the lanai of his condominium in Honolulu, Hawaii, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Campbell was in rare form, telling old Irish jokes, outlining his plans for the next 5 books he wanted to write, and speaking animatedly over and over again about The Hero's Journey, which he and his wife, Jean Erdman, had just watched for the first time. Together with Stuart Brown, the executive producer of the film, I had brought the film to Hawaii to screen for them and get their final approval before we officially released it. "It's marvelous, just marvelous," I remember him saying, as moonlight flickered on the sea below and warm breezes fluttered in the palm fronds. I asked him if he was surprised by the tributes he had received in the film by such people as filmmaker George Lucas, psychologist James Hillman, and novelist Richard Adams. "I couldn't be more pleased," he said. "You know, I didn't write my books for critics and scholars. I wrote them for students and artists. When I hear how much my work has meant to them, well, I can't tell you how happy it makes me. That means that this great stuff of myth, which I have been so privileged to work with, will be kept alive for a whole new generation. That's the function of the artist, you know, to reinterpret the old stories and make them come alive again in poetry, paintings, and now movies." Campbell paused, took a sip from his glass of Glenlivet, and then said directly to me in a way I will never forget, while clinking glasses with me, "That's why it's important for you to keep doing what you're doing and make this work your own." This was a reference to an ongoing discussion we had had for years about the classes I had been co-teaching with fellow screenwriters, such as Thomas Schlesinger, Keith Cunningham, Christopher Vogler, and Richard Beben, called Myth, Dream, and the Movies. My friends and I had been inspired to use his model of the hero's journey to better understand the archetypal and dreamlike structure of movies. Admittedly, I was nervous the first time I shared my notes and my drawings of the great wheel of the hero's journey in myth and movies, but he was the personification of enthusiasm. In the tradition of great mentors, he immediately gave me the courage of my convictions to carry on with the work wherever it may lead. "Oh, I think it's wonderful," he had said. "This is all I ever wanted, to help students and artists see myth as a reflection of the one sublime adventure of life, and then to breathe new life into it." Later that same year, in October 1987, Campbell died at age 83. Not long after, the sales of his books and videotapes skyrocketed, and his name became synonymous with mythology. Our film, The Hero's Journey, was released to great acclaim, and I was called upon to screen it in dozens of venues all over the country and in Europe. One evening I showed it to a standing room audience at the Open Center in New York, with his wife, Jean, seated in the front row. Afterward, I asked what she thought Joe would have said about his sudden mass culture popularity. She replied with a twinkle in her eye, "I'm sure he would have said that we would have to move to Bora Bora because all the phone calls and letters would have interfered with his work." Since the first publication of this book in 1990, I have received letters from virtually all over the world from people of every imaginable walk of life. If there is a common thread among them, it is the desire to express gratitude to Joseph Campbell for helping them discover the journey they are on in life. I heard from a house painter in Michigan who said the model of the hero's journey helped him see every new project as an adventure. A sculptor from New York wrote to tell me that he had been reminded about the eternal radiance of mythic forms. A man from Folsom Prison in California wrote to say that he now felt far less alone in the labyrinth of his journey. A former NFL football player attended one of my workshops and said he used the model to help convince ex-athletes that there is more than one journey, that life keeps revolving if you know how to change your story. A Silicon Valley consultant sent me a diagram he had made adapting the hero's journey for people in the business world, saying it helped them see a beginning, a middle, and an end in every business deal. A doctor from Sao Paulo, Brazil, emailed me to say that he reread the book several times because it helped him find meaning in the work he was doing in the barrios. There have also been countless well-known people who have contacted me, like Mike Pinder, founder of the rock group The Moody Blues, who said Campbell's work persuaded him to donate the rest of his life to bringing myths and music to young people. Lionel Poilin, the legendary baker in Paris, told me he had learned about the importance of emphasizing the origins of bread in his interviews after reading Campbell. After one of my lectures at UCLA, Mai Haley, the widow of Alex Haley, approached me to quietly let me know that Campbell's work had been a major reason why her husband had taken the long journey by ship back to Africa to research roots. Architect Anthony Lawler wrote to me that Campbell's writing reminded him of his passion for design that redefines sanctuary in our uncertain times. The cosmologist Brian Swim told me he thought Campbell was the psychic equivalent of the genome project, that every thinking person has to come to grips with this amazing truth. We now have all the ancient deep codes in our hands. Now what will we do with such inconceivable power? An ex-priest on the Aran Islands named Dara Malloy told me Campbell's work gave him the impetus to demythologize the Christianity he had inherited and to suggest a more appropriate mythology for our time based on ancient Celtic teachings. The songwriter R.B. Morris told me backstage in Knoxville, Tennessee, that Campbell's work persuaded him to hold on to the great myths of his early life, from Appalachian tales to James Agee, and allow them to grow within his own music. And then there was Reuben Snake, the powerful Winnebago medicine man, who told me that Campbell's books and films were now being used by the elders in many Native American schools to help revive interest in Indian mythology. Surely this response would have warmed the cockles of his Irish heart, as would this re-release of the hero's journey for what would have been his 100th birthday in 2004. If it's true, as poet John Donne said, that death is an ascent to a better library, I believe Joe Campbell is enjoying eternity by reading from the inexhaustible book of myth. Phil Cousineau, San Francisco, March 2003. Introduction. Joseph Campbell's long odyssey through the seas of ancient mythology was as much a spiritual quest as it was a scholarly one. Through his prodigious readings, writings, and travels, as well as his crossroads meetings with many of the century's most influential men and women, he discovered remarkable parallels in our world's mythological heritage and reinforcement for the deep conviction he had held since he was a young student, that there is a fundamental unity at the heart of nature. Truth is one. The sages speak of it by many names. He often quoted the Vedas. To synthesize the constant truths of history became the burning point of his life. To bridge the abyss between science and religion, mind and body, east and west, with the timeless linkage of myths, became his task of tasks. My hope, he wrote in his preface to The Hero with a Thousand Faces, is that a comparative elucidation may contribute to the perhaps not quite desperate cause of those forces that are working in the present world for unification, not in the name of some ecclesiastical or political empire, but in the name of human mutual understanding. Campbell's comparative historical approach to mythology, religion, and literature, in contrast to the conventional scholar's emphasis on cultural differences, concentrated on similarities. He was convinced that the common themes or archetypes in our sacred stories and images transcended the variations or cultural manifestations. Moreover, he believed that a reviewing of such primordial images in mythology as the hero, death and resurrection, the virgin birth, and the promised land, the universal aspects of the soul, the blood memories, could reveal our common psychological roots. They could even show us, as seen from below, how the soul views itself. Myths are the masks of God, he wrote, through which men everywhere have sought to relate themselves to the wonders of existence. The shock of recognition we receive from the timelessness of these images, from primal cultures to the most contemporary, he believed, was an illumination not only of our inward life, but of the same deep spiritual ground from which all human life springs. So as Albert Einstein pursued a unified field theory for the energies of the outer realms, Joseph Campbell dedicated himself to forging a kind of unified field theory of the equally prodigious energies of the inner realms, the personifications of which we call the gods. And what physicists call the fabric of reality, Campbell called the net of gems, a sparkling metaphor from Hindu cosmology that is also a keen image for his own unique weaving together of myth, religion, science, and art. His teachers in those disciplines, he concluded, were all saying essentially the same thing, that there is a system of archetypal impulses that have stirred the human spirit throughout history. It is, as he synthesized it, one grandiose song. The iconoclastic road he took as scholar, teacher, and writer was not unlike the left-hand paths he discovered in myriad myths, what the Kino Upanishads call the crossing of a bridge as sharp as the edge of a razor, the taking of the middle way of the Buddhists, or the entering of the dark forest of the Grail Quest, where there is no way or path. Intuitively, he followed his Tao of scholarship beyond the hallowed halls of traditional academia and into a spiritual and psychological view of mythology, which embraces the transcendent reality referred to by saints and shamans that can be directly experienced. This form of direct perception of what the mystics call cosmic consciousness is nothing less than a personal encounter with the gods. It is the healing vision of order underlying apparent chaos, the seizure of life-affirming beauty in the heart of darkness. If snatching the eternal out of the ever-fleeting is one of the great tricks of human existence, as Tennessee Williams said, then those who can experience eternity now, from Campbell's challenging perspective, become our tricksters, our spiritual guides. Campbell's decidedly unconventional career deprived him, he used to joke, of some prestige from his fellow scholars. But it was obvious to those of us who knew him that he took great pride in being the maverick and the dilettante, the one who takes delight in, as he once described his own mentor, the Indologist Heinrich Zimmer. He could afford to. His enthusiasm, literally his being full of the gods, had won him the hearts and minds of students early on in his career at Sarah Lawrence, and later of scores of artists. His own fascination with the great stuff of myth turned thinking into an adventure, translated knowledge into wisdom, and revealed the personal relevance of mythology for those who heard or read him. To them, he was far more than the popularizer who trivializes his subject. He was what the French elegantly call the animateur, the charismatic teacher who not only animates complex material for the average audience, but evokes what Vladimir Nabokov called the frisson, the telling shiver of truth about your own life. For that gift alone, he became one of the most beloved teachers of our time. Yet after more than 50 years of teaching and more than 20 books, Campbell felt that his contribution was simply that he gave people the key to the realm of the muses, that marvelous realm beyond the visible one from which imagination and inspiration could guide us in shaping our lives. In that role, he was a modern mystagogue, a guide through the often inscrutable mysteries of the ancient texts of Beowulf, Gilgamesh, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Egyptian mysteries, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Arthurian romances, the American Indian myths, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Christianity, as well as such modern mythmakers as James Joyce, Thomas Mann, and Pablo Picasso. In his rendering of these majestic narratives and images, he taught us the poet's way of how to read a myth, the original title for The Hero with a Thousand Faces, symbolically, metaphorically, soulfully. But beyond his talent for metamorphosis, that is, his ability to read into these transformative riddles of life and death, Campbell personalized the classics like few scholars before him. To complement the rigorous methods of scholarship, he revived the art of hermeneutics, inventive interpretations in the spirit of Hermes, the soul guide, and fused them with the glint-in-the-eye regaling of a wise Irish storyteller. In so doing, he breathed new life into the old myths, as Albert Camus said each generation must do. As he did with one of his favorite tales, the Parsifal legend, when he threw down the gauntlet at the end of his Arthurian romance seminars. So is it going to be the Grail Quest, or is it going to be the Wasteland? He would ask. Are you going to go on the creative soul's quest, or are you going to pursue the life that only gives you security? Are you going to follow the star of the zeal of your own enthusiasm? Are you going to live the myth? Or is the myth going to live you? And so reemerged the ecstatic scholar, a breed of thinker thought long extinct since the age of scientific rationalism. It's not the agony of the quest, he often reminded his audiences, but the rapture of the revelation. giving new meaning to the old saw about rapture of the deep. Furthermore, he would add gnomishly, life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived. But how is this possible? Can we do more than wait for the serendipitous encounter? How do we turn around the flight from mystery in this demythologized era with its overarching question, is nothing sacred anymore? How do we separate the sham from the sublime? Joseph Campbell's patented response to the disenchantment of modern life was, find your life's passion and follow it. Follow the path that is no path. Follow your bliss. When you have the unmistakable experience of the aha, then you'll know you're riding on the mystery. Campbell's irrepressible urge to pursue his own bliss into the essential knowledge, the hidden harmonies within the dream world of myths, legends, fairy tales, folklore, poetry, literature, and art, is reminiscent of what John Keats described in Shakespeare as the circumnavigation of the soul. While Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung rescued the soul from the oblivion of the spiritual materialism of the 19th century with the study of depth psychology, Campbell's cross-cultural explorations, and those of a host of other modern religious historians and anthropologists like Mircea Eliade and Claude Lévi-Strauss, revived our moribund myths in their ancestral home of the stories and images of the soul. Together and alone, they were dreaming the myth onward, as Jung advised, reweaving the ancient story web. Campbell's sojourn inevitably took him to the perennial philosophy. The sublime theme he found in the ancient Hindu and Chinese pundits, Sufi and Christian mystics, poets and philosophers from Walt Whitman to Aldous Huxley, was that deep within the human soul is a mirror of divine reality. As above, so below. Tat vam asi. Thou art that. The kingdom of God is within us, here and now. Awakening to that mystical dimension where the very essence of the self is suddenly perceived to be one with the ultimate forces of nature is at once the secret and the transforming journey of human life. You are that mystery which you are seeking to know, Campbell concluded. This spiritual perspective, Campbell believed, is not only timeless, but universal. He had as great a respect for the wisdom lore of the shamans and sages of antiquity as he did for the creative visions of contemporary artists and scientists. Accordingly, like many other perennial philosophers, Campbell had very little patience, if not disdain, for any individual or chosen people mythologies that excluded others from divine revelation or claimed to possess exclusive knowledge of what he vigorously thought to be the fundamental truths, the sacred constants of all people. Every people is a chosen people, he insisted. Every deity is a metaphor, a mask, for the ultimate mystery ground, the transcendent energy source of the universe that is also the mysterious source of your own life, and everyone else's. In light of this, Campbell realized after years of being asked earnest questions about ultimate answers that when people say they're looking for the meaning of life, what they're really looking for is a deep experience of it. As a mythologist with a metaphysical slant on life, a doctor of things beyond appearances, he dedicated his life to mapping out the experience of plumbing those depths, which is the journey of the soul itself. The cartography, as he drew it, was the geography of the inner or underworld, showing perilous territory to be traversed not by the faint, but by the stout of heart. If myths emerge like dreams out of the psyche, he reasoned, they can also lead us back in. The way out is the way in. It is a movement beyond the known boundaries of faith and convention, the search for what matters, the path of destiny, the route of individuality, the road of original experience, a paradigm for the forging of consciousness itself. In short, the hero's journey. A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. This monomyth lies at the core of Joseph Campbell's steadfast belief in one universal mythology. Like the legendary griffin, the winged lion of the medieval bestiary, it was a composite, taking shape gradually, piece by piece, an innovative assemblage of key ideas from Campbell's own masters, Joyce, Mann, Jung, Zimmer, Underhill, Kumaraswamy, and Ortega y Gasset, who wrote in an influential passage that the will to be oneself is heroism. The monomyth is, in effect, a meta-myth, a philosophical reading of the unity of humankind's spiritual history, the story beyond the story. To paraphrase the ancient Japanese koan, it is the sound of one myth clapping, the universal quest for self-transformation. The journey of the hero is about the courage to seek the depths, the image of creative rebirth, the eternal cycle of change within us, the uncanny discovery that the seeker is the mystery which the seeker seeks to know. The hero journey is a symbol that binds, in the original sense of the word, two distant ideas, the spiritual quest of the ancients with the modern search for identity. Always the one shape-shifting yet marvelously constant story that we find. Joseph Campbell's life spanned the years from Buffalo Bill to Star Wars. His work from Apollo the Greek god to Apollo the spacecraft. His was truly a story with a thousand faces. And Stuart Brown's dream of documenting that protean story was a vision journey in its own right. For years, Campbell had shied away from film crews, deflecting the cult of celebrity by reminding people that, it's not me, it's the myths. And the prying eyes of biography from audiences by insisting, I've spent all my life trying to stay out of the way of this stuff. No doubt his colorful telling of Odysseus's describing himself as no man to the Cyclops in Homer's great epic was as much an element of his self-image as the Grail Quest or the dream sequences from Finnegan's Wake. Outside of a few in-depth interviews, he instinctively lived out what the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke referred to when he wrote about the creative life. True art comes from the anonymous self. Nevertheless, there were choice passages here and there, in our own filming of him over the 3-year period, in the scattered interviews found in library stacks, and during our casual conversations with him about how he had recognized in meandering through the maze of his own life the various stages of the hero journey. The calls to adventure, the mentors and allies, the threshold guardians, the dark forest, the bringing back of the boon to the community. Once the group decision was made to approach Joe about supplementing the original Esalen material with personal interviews at his home in Honolulu, I was elected to reassure him that now that we had the ideas on film, we were simply looking for the links between them. For the sake of the dramatic structure of the documentary, I told him, we thought our story would be even more compelling if we could chronicle the nature of his learning process. How did he discover the themes that became the crossbeams of his work? Why did he connect the Navajo material to the Hindu? When did he first align in his mind the twilight myths of the Celts with Joyce's Nightworld novels? Only after all the filming was completed and we hunkered down in the editing room did the theme of the hero journey become the Ariadne's thread that led us through the labyrinth of film footage. Convoluted as the conversations and interviews sometimes were, ranging from the Upanishads to Kant, the Gnostic Gospels to Black Elk, there was now the clue, C-L-E-W, the skein of Ariadne's thread that Theseus used to lead himself out of the labyrinth, the origin of our word, clue. The winding thread of Campbell's path through his own labyrinth, the relevance of the work to his own life, which made sense of his sometimes arcane connections. The moments of synchronicity, and then the whole world opened up, that highlighted his life, confirmed his deep belief that devotion to one's own inner work is the beam that keeps you on the path. Over and over again, we discovered, he looked back through the years in the manner of Schopenhauer, who wrote about the well-lived life appearing in retrospect like a well-written novel. The first encounters with friends like Jiddu Krishnamurti, John Steinbeck, Ed Ricketts, Alan Watts, and above all his wife Jean Erdman, he would describe more like epiphanies or powerful chapters than anecdotes. And of the enormous influence he had on creative artists, he appeared profoundly grateful that such an epilogue could have been written to the story of his life's work. Stuart Brown's 8-year labor of love, The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell, premiered at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in February 1987. 7 months later, Joseph Campbell died quietly in his home in Honolulu at the age of 83. During the approximately 10 years between Brown's vision of popularizing Campbell at a time when few people wanted to hear about mythology, and the time our film was finally released, an astonishing turnaround had taken place. Campbell's fame had spread from a devoted audience of ex-students and avid readers to popular culture. Filmmakers like George Lucas and George Miller, sculptor Isamu Noguchi, rock stars David Byrne and the Grateful Dead, priests, poets, psychologists, and even comedians were all publicly expressing their debt and admiration of him. The following summer, The Hero's Journey and Bill Moyers' interviews with Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, were shown on PBS. The ensuing Campbell phenomenon took everyone by surprise. Who would have believed that the American public would ever be interested in listening to a scholar and a journalist discuss religion for 7 hours? Nevertheless, Campbell's cassette and book sales soared. Discussion groups formed in schoolrooms, therapists' offices, church basements, Zen centers, and story conference rooms in Hollywood. The appeal went far beyond elitist debates about diffusion versus parallelism theories of anthropology, beyond the romanticizing of mythical Camelots and Troys. Instead, the country was mesmerized by a passionate storyteller, a robust athlete and musician turned dignified philosopher and writer. The exciting blend of Campbell's universal humanism and secular spirituality. Here was the background music of the spheres, a skeleton key to open the door to the worlds of art, literature, and religion. Most important, he was saying that myths have to do with how you live your life. In an era undermined by a pervasive feeling of deep skepticism and anxiety, appeared someone who insisted that we find what electrifies and enlivens our hearts and wakes us. In fact, the public found in Joseph Campbell what the poet W.B. Yeats called the old eagle's mind, the wise old man, the rarest of archetypes in a land of eternal youth. Campbell's message that myths matter galvanized the long-dormant cultural discussion about the spiritual and aesthetic life. In the winter of 1986, at a memorable conference in San Francisco entitled From Ritual to Rapture, starring Joseph Campbell, psychiatrist John Perry, and the Grateful Dead, Jerry Garcia brought the house down by confessing on stage to the old mythologist his feelings about the similarities between the ancient mystery festivals and rock concerts. "They didn't know what they were saying, and we don't know what we're saying either, but we think we're saying the same thing." Not everyone understood myths overnight, but suddenly the old dream of a common language had been revived. After its debut on public television, I took the hero's journey around the country and to Europe to show in movie theaters, university auditoriums, and at film festivals. Audiences everywhere stayed after the screenings for unusually long, probing question-and-answer sessions. When I began showing specially selected outtakes, passages from the hours and hours of film footage that never made the final cut of the film, to my own myth and movies seminars, and continued to get delightful feedback, it became exhilaratingly clear that we had a treasure trove of material left over. I approached Dr. Brown about rescuing the hours of outtakes from obscurity of film vaults and organizing them into a book to meet the groundswell of interest. He generously gave me access not only to the film footage, but to hours of videotaped lectures, and encouraged me to create a companion book to the film. For that, I am deeply grateful. My interest in working with the original transcripts was also inspired by a driving curiosity to seek out in the hieroglyphics of nearly 1,500 pages of disjointed conversations, interviews, and speeches the intriguing relationship between Campbell's personal journey and the evolution of his work. How did he reconcile his accumulation of such a staggering amount of knowledge, which included an unflinching look into the dark shadows of the human condition, with a life-affirming philosophy? A seeming paradox in the heart of the labyrinth reared its minotaur head. If the old gods are dead and the traditional myths are out of date, as Campbell insisted, why even study them, let alone rhapsodize about them? It can only be hoped that the following confluence of conversations, interviews, speeches, and book quotes evokes Campbell's moving response, that we are in what the Greeks called the time of the metamorphoses of the gods. The images of the new gods, the new creative myths, the global vision are being born not anew out there, but in the mythogenic zone of the awakened human heart. There, reformed for our different times, are the different metaphors to express the constant truths, and therein the courage can be found to join with joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. This immortal teaching of affirmation and compassion, which Campbell found in the teachings of the Buddha, gave him the courage of his own convictions. This, I am convinced, is his greatest legacy. The actual transformation of the transcripts into book form follows my exploration through the records of the original filming at Esalen Institute, the National Arts Club, and finally the Campbell home in Honolulu. I also had the great fortune of being able to select passages from the videotaped lectures on The Perennial Philosophy, James Joyce and Thomas Mann, and Psyche and Symbol from Joe Campbell's last official lecture tour, which Dr. Brown, with tremendous foresight and courage, videotaped between 1982 and 1983, as well as the audiotaped panel discussion after the West Coast premiere of The Hero's Journey at the Directors Guild in Los Angeles in May 1987. Considerable editing was necessary to reconstruct the parallel journey of the work and the man. Where reconstructions were needed, as when there were the inevitable but exasperating gaps in the filming because the sound dropped away or conversations overlapped, I was able to resort to my own notes taken from Campbell's seminars, workshops, and personal conversations. Trusting the lead of Joe's personal asides that highlighted the entire round of filming, the story slowly unfolded chapter by chapter, as it had for him. Other stories, other renditions will follow this one, perhaps more comprehensive and less schematic. But these interviews stand alone as the telling of the tale by the light of the fire by the teller himself. Perhaps the self-synthesis that emerges was his last brilliant metaphor, a flickering image of the task that is before all of us today. One of the last times I saw Joe Campbell, in late spring of 1987, was in the Redwood Room of the Clift Hotel in San Francisco. That night, as we had so often before in what we called our version of the philosopher's long conversation, the one between minds long gone, still here, and yet to come, we spoke with great joy about two of our favorite topics, Joyce and Paris, and the bittersweet relationship between the artist and the city. Over a final glass of Glenlivet, I confided to him a favorite story of my own. A few years before, I was drifting across the country on a motorcycle trip when, like a wayward traveler in an Arabian Nights tale tripping over a gold nugget hidden under a tree root in the dark forest, I discovered an uncanny scene that struck me as being at the heart of the hero's journey. It was that of a crumbling tombstone in Boot Hill Cemetery in Tombstone, Arizona, the grave marker of an old gunslinger. The epitaph read, "Be what you is, 'cause if you be what you ain't, then you ain't what you is." I can hear Joe's hearty bodhisattva laugh now, and the clink of our glasses over the soothing sounds of the late-night jazz piano in the old redwood-paneled bar. "That's it," he cried out with that eternal look of wonder in his eyes. "That's what it's all about, the mystery of the journey. That's just marvelous." Now, how did that go again? Be what you is. Phil Cousineau. Chapter 1. The Call to Adventure.
The call to adventure signifies that destiny has summoned the hero and transferred his spiritual center of gravity from within the pale of this society to a zone unknown. This fateful region of both treasure and danger may be variously represented, as a distant land, a forest, a kingdom underground, beneath the waves or above the sky, a secret island, lofty mountaintop, or profound dream state. But it is always a place of strangely fluid and polymorphous beings, unimaginable torments, superhuman deeds, and impossible delights.
Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Joseph Campbell was born in New York City on March 26, 1904, the son of Charles and Josephine Campbell. His passion for mythology began when he was a young boy, and his father took him and his younger brother Charlie to Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at Madison Square Garden, and to the Museum of Natural History, where he became fascinated with Indian totem poles. By the time he was 12, he was voraciously reading books about American Indians. He soon recognized the parallels between these stories and those of his own Roman Catholic tradition, a discovery that would fire a cross-cultural study in the arcane discipline of mythology for the rest of his life. As a student at prep school in New Milford, Connecticut, his favorite studies were biology and math. He went on to attend Dartmouth in 1921 for 1 year studying biology and mathematics, but felt a complete disorientation there and even considered dropping out of college to enter business. In the summer of 1922, a family friend gave him a biography of Leonardo da Vinci that so inspired him, he transferred to Columbia University to shift my interest from science to cultural history and the humanities. Stuart Brown, Can you tell us about your grandparents and your Irish background?
Joseph Campbell. I didn't really know my grandparents well. My father's father came over at the end of the potato famine in Ireland. He was a peasant, and he became a gardener on an estate in Waltham, Massachusetts. My father grew up there. And his mother also was from Ireland. As a boy, Dad got a job in a department store and became one of their major salesmen, and then they sent him to New York to open the New York office, so I was born in New York. I remember when I was a little boy visiting my grandfather. He had a great white beard, as a grandfather ought to. That's about all I remember. That was a long, long, long way back. And my mother's father I met only once. Mother was a New York girl, but her mother was from Scotland and was a pretty, lovely, wonderful woman, and she took very good care of us. My mother had a beautiful brother who was a glorious swimmer. He died of diabetes when he was around 22. I can remember swimming with him when I was a kid. He was the only other person in the family that played a role at all in the building of my ideals and idealism. I never thought very much about being thoroughly Celtic Irish until well on in my college years, when I began to get a real sense of what the Celtic consciousness was and what a good fortune it was to come out of that realm of wonderful, rich verbal fantasy. The whole fairyland world of Europe is out of Ireland, really. And then in my graduate years, I became interested in the Arthurian material, which is thoroughly Celtic, and gradually I got a sense of my relationship to their mentality.
What were your boyhood years like? Were you an avid student?
From very early, around 4 or 5 years old, I was fascinated by American Indians, and that became my real studying. I went to school and had no problems with my studies, but my own enthusiasm was in this maverick realm of the American Indian mythologies. We lived in New Rochelle, New York in those years, right next door to the public library. When I was about 11, I had read all the books about Indians in the children's library and was actually admitted to the stacks. I remember coming home from the library with stacks of books, and I think that's where my life as a scholar began. I know it did. There they all were, all the reports of the Bureau of Ethnology, Frank H. Cushing and Franz Boas and the lot of them. By the time I was 13, I knew about as much about the American Indian as a good many anthropologists that I have met since. They know the sociological interpretations of why the Indians are the way they are, or were, but they don't know much about Indians, and I did know.
Did you have any heroes in your youth? Any lionized characters who became an early mentor for you?
Well, my parents found a lovely place in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania along about 1917, and right nearby was a man whose books about Indians I had been reading. And so, he became my first guru, or teacher. His name was Elmer Gregor, and he wrote books about American Indians. He had been out in the Indian country. In those days, this is 1912, 13, 14, 15, the Indian wars were still going on, and the only good Indian was a dead Indian, and all of that. So there were Indians in the wind, even though we were in the east. And so this beautiful place became my real discovery of nature. My emphasis on biology and nature and the body in my writing about myth comes out of those years. It is really a combination that comes from this man, who was a naturalist as well as an Indian scholar. He put me right on the road. Elmer Gregor. I remember him as a great. We used to communicate across the dining room with Indian sign language and all that kind of thing. My career as a mythologist began almost immediately with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at Madison Square Garden, 1910. He came for 2 or 3 years, then he died, and the group that replaced him was called the 101 Ranch. One of the Indians in the sideshow was Iron Tail, whose head had just appeared on the Indian Head nickel. He'd sit in profile to the people who filed by as they took their nickels out of their pockets, looked, bowed their heads, and went on.
Joseph Campbell, Esquire, September 1977. Brown. It sounds as if your interest in Indians really was rising as much out of yourself as from any direct encouragement from your family.
My parents were very, very cooperative, but I found it myself. They helped me go on with it, but they were business people. They had no scholarship. but they met people who could help them find the books that I could use, and so really I had wonderful help there. Meanwhile, in school, I was doing the things one has to do, studying what was given me to study, and I enjoyed it all. But the real stuff was off on this side.
I've never heard you speak much about your own background in Roman Catholicism, the church, and its rituals.
I was in a day school convent in New York with the nuns until, oh my lord, I was about 15. And when you're born in an Irish Catholic family and environment and spend your boyhood with nuns and you're serving Mass, I was a little altar boy, you're studying the Catholic doctrine all the time with deep belief. And I think anyone who has not been a Catholic in that sort of substantial way has no realization of the ambiance of religion within which you live. It's powerful, it's potent, it's life-supporting, and it's beautiful. The Catholic religion is a poetic religion. Every month has its poetic and spiritual value. Boy, that got into me. I'm sure that my interest in mythology comes out of that. I notice when I read the work of scholars or artists or novelists who are really interested in myth as a life-structuring thing, not something that's just fantasy, but deeper,